Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
We're giving them the paid day off as a signal and a symbol that this is a necessary campaign to support.
Dozens of CEOs are giving their teams the day off in a protest for federal paid leave. If you're listening to this on your commute home, sorry that you weren't one of them. It's Monday, March 18th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, documenting the carnage in Gaza takes a heavy toll on Palestinian photojournalists. Also, one way tourists can help with wildfire recovery in Hawaii? Walking dogs at the Maui Humane Society.
Hi!
I mean, someone has to be their voice. That's why we are here. I know that's why I'm here.
But first, the U.S. is one of just a few countries in the world with no national program for paid parental leave. 13 states have laws that pay for up to 3 months of leave while workers care for a family member or themselves. But today, more than 70 businesses and nonprofits are closing their offices in protest to call attention to the lack of federal paid leave. Janelle Tavis is Chief Commercial Officer in North America for Bugaboo. They make strollers and other products that parents might know. And she tells Deepa Fernandez that's one reason they're eager to participate in this protest.
How we've participated in this campaign is that we're closing our corporate doors. So our entire team of nearly 30 across the U.S. and Canada are not coming into work today. And we're giving them the paid day off as a signal and a symbol that this is a necessary campaign to support. Our online sales are open. We don't have our customer service team or logistics online right now, but we are taking orders and those will go out tomorrow.
So how does family leave at your company currently work? What happens if an employee has a new baby or adopts or I guess even has to take care of a sick parent and needs time off?
Yeah, when I first joined Bugaboo, I was 6 months postpartum myself. I was a new mom. I had my son in the middle of the pandemic following a really difficult pregnancy and delivery during that time. And it was that experience as a new mother, which really informed how we wanted to create change within the company. So over the last 3 years, we have been really working to formally extend and make changes to our U.S. handbook. Now we have 16 fully paid weeks is what we offer, plus a flexible return to work plan, meaning that the parent can come back in reduced part-time hours to really transition in and but still get paid for full time.
And so that cost falls squarely on your business. How does not having paid federal leave affect you? What would happen if there was paid federal leave, seeing as though you're already giving it to your employees?
Well, it would take the financial stress certainly off the company. And what we have seen, though, and what I would urge other companies to think about, it does become an incremental personnel cost to our company. But what I believe and what we've seen firsthand is that when you institute formal leave policies and policies that support the well-being of your employees, what that creates are happy and well individuals and ultimately high-performing teams.
Yeah. And I'm wondering what kind of federal paid leave you'd like to see. What are you calling on Congress to do?
I would say, I mean, at the minimum, I would call for 12 weeks because I think that is at the stage that we know that mothers have physically and also mentally started to recover and heal and are able to re-enter the workplace. It's still very early compared to a lot of other leave programs, but it would really then be available and offered to every parent, regardless of what business or where they're employed.
Bugaboo is a Dutch company. Janelle, tell us about federal leave policies there. Is that possibly a model for us, what happens in the Netherlands?
Yes. Yeah, so in the Netherlands, the federal leave benefit is 16 weeks to every new parent. So that is paid by
the government.
That is paid, exactly. That is paid by the government. And so the Bugaboo North America, the company, we assume that responsibility as a company in the U.S. in lieu of that federal leave absence.
And just talk to me about how that helps you as a business owner, you know, be that in the Netherlands or Germany or other countries where you have business, the fact that the government actually pays that cost versus you as the individual business owner.
The benefit is that regardless if you're at a small business or you're at a large global brand like Bugaboo, that every parent receives the same financial security and also time to recover and heal. And so we have really seen a company benefit from an engagement standpoint, that we are really living our brand values is, which is to empower parents.
Janelle Tavis is Chief Commercial Officer in North America for the parenting products company Bugaboo, best known for their strollers. Thank you so much, Janelle.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up next, an Israeli delegation is headed to Qatar for new talks aimed at brokering a temporary ceasefire in Gaza. But things on the ground there have only gotten worse. The World Food Program said today that famine is imminent in northern Gaza. And we know people can die from malnutrition and hunger long before famine is officially declared. Also, early this morning, Israeli forces again raided Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest hospital in Gaza. After the break, we're going to step back from those headlines and follow up on other stories in Gaza. When we return, Robin Young talks to two of the journalists behind the Portraits of Gaza series, and we get updates on what's happened to some of the people photographed for that series, as well as how those images have helped illuminate the misery that Israel has imposed on Gazans in the war so far. Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator for Planet Money podcast on NPR.
I have a little collage board at my desk at work, notes, newspaper tear-outs, things I want to see. And in the middle, ever since it was on the front page of the New York Times, a photo I really don't want to see, but can't look away from. It's a little boy in the rubble in Gaza, his face contorted with grief, and still a tenderness beyond his years as he strokes the beautiful face of his lifeless little sister. It's a gut punch. The photo was taken by New York Times stringer Summer Abu Alouf, who said the boy was crying, "Where is my mom?" And Summer cried as she took the picture. Summer is Palestinian, a Gazan. In a video made by The Times, she talks about her February photo spread, Portraits of Gaza.
هذول الناس مش أرقام، هذول الناس كان إلهم أحلام وإلهم طموح.
She says her story was about how lives changed during the bombing. Then, these people are not numbers. These people had dreams and ambitions. And she goes on to say the stories added to her own fear that her own children, her family, would die. The war started by the brutal Hamas attack on Israelis, and now the brutal bombing campaign and ground attacks by Israel against Hamas goes on. Today, military troops entered a hospital, they say, in search of Hamas fighters. We hope to talk to Summer soon. She and her family have been evacuated from Gaza by the New York Times. But veteran Times journalist Declan Walsh, who traveled in Gaza with Summer and wrote the text for her pictures and is now in Nairobi, is here. Declan, welcome back.
Hi there, Robin.
And also with us today, New York Times senior photo editor Mona Bushnak. She joins us from London. Mona, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Start with Khalid Judah. He's the 9-year-old boy saying goodbye to his 8-month-old sister. Now, the Times at the time, the end of last year, reported that he'd already also said goodbye to his mother, father, older brother, and sister. They'd all been killed. Do we know how he is doing?
Khalid is in Gaza with one of his brothers, his younger brother, a 7-year-old, who also survived the attack. They were taken care of by their uncles. And his younger brother had actually wounds from the attack. And Summer ran into them weeks after she took that incredibly powerful photo that you described. She ran into them at the hospital while Khalid and his brother were there basically for treatment. And she visited them. And to our knowledge, they still remain in Gaza.
Summer, how is she doing?
It has been an incredibly difficult journey for Samar to leave the Gaza Strip. Samar is a mother at heart, and she left because she wanted her children to be safe, but her heart remained in Gaza, where the rest of her family, her parents, her sisters, one of them just gave birth 2 days ago in a tent, and another one had given birth to twins in the first week of the war, and that sister with the twins and her husband have been in North Gaza. And actually, the last I checked a few days ago, they couldn't find formula for the babies, and they were barely finding food for the family. So she wishes to return to be able to document the war and to check in on her family.
Well, Summer, in that video that the Times made, said, as you indicated, she worried she might lose her children. And Declan, she had such powerful, good reason to fear this, documenting so many children who'd lost their lives, but also documenting a fellow photojournalist, Mohammed Al-Alul. He was sitting in a car. This photo is stunning. His head is tilted back. His eyes are closed. He's cradling the body of one of his young children, one of his 4 children, all brothers, who were killed in an Israeli airstrike.
The photograph that we're talking about, even now, I think I find it hard to look at. Mohammed, just like Summer, very typical of this core of Palestinian journalists who have really been the eyes and ears of the world. And in his case, resulted really in this excruciating loss. Here's this man who really hadn't been seeing very much of his family since the war started. He worked for a Turkish news agency. He had been away from home most of the time, covering the impact of mostly Israeli airstrikes. And then one day, according to the reporting we had, really his worst fears came through when he got a call from some of his colleagues who said, an airstrike has struck what we think is your home. And then there was just this chaotic sequence of events, which resulted in him finding that 4 of his own 5 children had been killed. One of the other photographs that we have shows him standing, holding his last surviving child, a 1-year-old boy called Adam. And since then, like Summer, Mohammed has been evacuated by his employer. He's currently, I believe, in Turkey, where his wife, who was very seriously injured in the same strike, is now receiving medical treatment.
I wonder, Declan, I mean, you have been in so many war zones. You were in Gaza. You befriend these people, and then you leave. Look, they, I'm sure, would tell us they are desperate to get these photographs out. But is there any, do you ever feel any guilt or conflict about even asking them to do it?
The point is that in this conflict in Gaza, initially at least, they didn't really have any choice. Gaza was closed to international journalists, except on very rare occasions with the Israeli military on embeds. But for the Gazan journalists who were there, I think many of them just felt this great sense of obligation that because no other media were able to access the area, that the responsibility had fallen on them. But as we've seen in this conflict, it's not just about the great personal risks so many of them have run. And don't forget that perhaps close to 100 Palestinian journalists have died in this war. That's one of the worst death tolls of any conflict in the last number of decades. Mm. But also their own families are in the firing line. We hear it with the story of Summer as well. When she was taking the photographs, not only was she having to basically act as the reporter because I was unable to get there, but also she was trying to keep her own family safe, trying to find food, medical attention, and just, of course, worrying every single day about what was going to happen to them. And as I understand it from Summer now, she is torn between, you know, her great professionalism and desire to bear witness, and of course, the need to keep her family safe.
Yeah. And Mana, as the editor who, you know, sifts through these images, how do you choose? Some would say we are seeing the faces of dead children. It's too graphic. It's intrusive. We know that opinion columnist Lydia Pogreen has said it's a moral obligation to see them. Where do you draw the line? How do you decide?
There's just so many moving photos of whether it's wounded children receiving treatment and crying in pain and agony. And, you know, what I wish I could do is to be there and hold their hand and help them. It's difficult to sift through hundreds, if not thousands, of these pictures sometimes a day. I agree personally that it is a moral obligation, but it is a line that we have to think about. There's also a difference when it's a picture that's gory or gruesome that will only make the reader turn the page or quickly scroll because it won't get the point of the war, of the pain, of the misery, the danger, the risks that people are going through. It is a decision based on discussions with photo editors and senior managers and standards.
Yeah. Of course, there were terrible images that came out of the Hamas attack on the kibbutzim in Israel. The New York Times did a special report on sexual assaults during those attacks. Editors had to sift through terrible photographs and videos that were taken by the Hamas attackers. The New York Times is standing by its reporting on that, but it's been a tough go there. And now I'm looking more at the pictures from Gaza. Here's little Mohammed, 12 years old, getting treated for burns. You know, war is horrible. These are not the first images. I'm thinking, you know, back to the image of the starving mother holding her starving child during the famine in Ethiopia. This was Stan Grossfeld's Pulitzer Prize-winning photo. Can you just briefly talk about the importance of the witness? Who's the photographer?
I mean, the most famous and slightly notorious famine picture is the vulture one because the photographer later committed suicide, I believe.
Yeah. Oh. This was Kevin Carter's photo of a starving girl struggling to reach a feeding station during a famine in Sudan, of vultures looking on. And given that, can you just briefly talk about the importance of the witness, the photographer?
Well, you know, part of the goal for us was to show those incredibly stark images we've been talking about. But part of the brief was also to show the stories of survival. And in fact, one of the most dramatic stories we have is about a woman who had given birth just a few hours before those October 7th attacks happened. And she told us about this dramatic journey across Gaza with her family and this newborn child in tow as there were, you know, fighter jets in the sky and passing corpses in the streets and bombs exploding, sometimes nearly killing her own family. And some of the photographs and the reporting here, we're hoping, gives a sense of how those people are getting through it. I think we're often drawn to the starkest and the most graphic images or the most disturbing ones. But I think it's important also to recognize that for many people, and indeed currently now for about 2 million residents of Gaza, for most people, every day is simply a kind of, you know, very frightening, difficult grind with the threat of famine. Our job as journalists in bearing witness to that is to give our readers a sense of the breadth of the suffering and of human experience in these really excruciating situations.
That's Declan Walsh, international correspondent for The New York Times. We've also been speaking with Mona Bushnak, New York Times photo editor, about some of the excruciating photos that have come out of the conflict in the Middle East and Gaza. Declan, Mona, thank you so much.
Sure, my pleasure. Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Robin and the rest of us will continue to follow all the news coming out of Gaza. And as we follow up with stories there, we're also checking back in on Hawaii, 7 months after the wildfires. Robin was recently on vacation in Maui. And when we return, with liberal use of the editorial we, she's going to describe one part of her trip volunteering as a dog walker with the Humane Society there, which has been overwhelmed. Thousands of people lost their homes, and so did hundreds of pets. We'll hear from some of them after the break.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Lisa in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more.
This message comes from NPR sponsor KeyBank. At KeyBank, they believe in delivering for their clients. Whatever the economic turn, KeyBank is primed to collaborate and help create solutions tailored to your ideas and your vision. With nearly 200 years of banking experience, they know a lot about being a trusted advisor. And whether you're managing growth, seeking solutions, or improving your bottom line, KeyBank is ready to be yours. KeyBank opens doors. Learn more at key.com/advisor. This message comes from NPR sponsor Arctic Wolf. Their researchers have released the Arctic Wolf Lab's 2024 threat report. Why will 2024 be a volatile year for cybersecurity? Learn more and get your copy now at arcticwolf.com/NPR.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beats. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
We recently visited family and friends on the West Coast and hopped over to Maui for a couple of days of renewal, which this gorgeous Hawaiian island still offers in spades, but there's also palpable pain. The August fires that roared through historic Lahaina, killing over 100, also displaced 5,000, many living in hotels, figuring out insurance, FEMA aid, food, school, work. The land in Lahaina is a scar. People are traumatized. Just south in Wailea, a woman in our hotel elevator told us it was her birthday. She was on staycation from Lahaina. Through tears, she said her cousin threw herself over the seawall to survive the flames, but had to leave her disabled husband behind her in their car because she couldn't get him out. And then she was gone. The elevator doors closed. We stood dumbstruck. We ate at local restaurants, shopped local markets, made donations. There must be something more we could do.
Hi.
A curious pooch pokes his snout through a kennel screen at the Maui Humane Society, several low-slung rustic buildings on a sprawling field. 3,000 animals from Lahaina went missing during the fires. Many were burned. Hundreds ended up here. The Humane Society was overwhelmed and still is. Here's animal care manager Keani Bannister. So, Keani, how many dogs are in here?
Oh, goodness. Right now we have maybe 60 to 70 dogs in shelter.
Is that a lot?
That is quite a lot. We have 40 kennels, 2 to 3 dogs a kennel. But it does get, crowded, stressful for the dogs.
Kiani explains there are plenty of hotel rooms on this island, but not enough homes to welcome dogs, and no other shelter on the island to transfer them to. The Maui Humane Society used to have a transfer program with California. It was called Wings of Aloha, but like many states, California is now overwhelmed with dogs adopted during COVID and now given up, so that's on hold. Well, and then here in Maui, of course, you have the fires 6 months ago.
Yes, oh goodness. Basically, half of our island was impacted, losing their homes, their families, their pets,
lives.
Their lives. The whole island feels it. The whole island grieves with our Lahaina families, our Lahaina pet owners, our Lahaina animals. So we did take in a lot of Lahaina animals, a lot of feral cats, wildlife, pigs, chickens, goats, just to get them out of the burn zones.
I heard earlier today that some hotels are looking the other way for the displaced families that they've put up and are letting them have their pets. But many families may have escaped the fires but had to give up their animals in order to take housing.
Yes, yes. We've had many cases like that. And that's a responsibility we respectfully take on to care after their dogs. You know, we want to respect and love their animals just as much as they did.
That's got to be heartbreaking.
Yes, it's been a new it's been a new emotion, sensation we've felt here at Maui Humane Society, talking with families that have lost. But you know, we want to do all we can, and we are striving to do all we can to help.
And then, of course, there are pets who lost their families, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yes, there are. Yes, very hard. It's a confusing concept for a dog to come into a shelter and not understand why. We can't communicate to them. We can't explain why they are here at the shelter. We can't explain where their families or owners may be. So, you know, we take the utmost careful observation, keeping in mind the dog's mental and physical health when they're in shelter, because we just want to provide them with the best experience we can here.
So, what can people do?
Oh my goodness, what can people do? You can come down and volunteer. We have dog walking, or if you just want to hang out with a dog for the day, that's our big program called Dog on Demand.
I demand a dog.
Yes, yes, it is.
What a good dog. What do you see? What do you see? Do you want to pee? There you go. What a good dog. Yes, I speak dog.
Yes.
And I'm talking to Trevor. As his bio says, he's a lovely 9-year-old, looks like a lab mix, who will need help getting in and out of the car, to which I say, who doesn't?
Puppy! Puppy!
We got complete instructions on taking Trevor for the day, and a seatbelt and harness to buckle him in. There's a little anxiety, but soon he's sprawled across the back seat, head nestled in my lap. We are going to the beach.
3.3 miles. Turn right onto North Kihei Road.
3.3 miles.
There are rules. No dog parks, no off-leash. We got a backpack with Adopt Me written on it and water bottles, bowls, and snacks. I wear that. Trevor wears a snazzy Adopt Me bandana. Now, Trevor was a stray. No one knows if he was escaping the fires. But there is something just right about this native Hawaiian getting to walk and run on a beach. A little drink of water. Soon, day's done. We come back to the Maui Humane Society to an office packed with volunteers.
Okay.
So, you also need walkers.
Yes, that takes one more level of training. The other thing you can do is our Dog on Demand program. And you can either sign
one couple is getting their backpack.
So, this is your backpack for the day. It has water bottles, a cup of water bowl, towels, toys, treats.
Again, Kiani Bannister.
It's very on demand. And there are more dogs that we want to get out of the shelter, just even for a day.
I have to say, it was having, I don't have my dogs anymore. Being able to have a dog is just, on this beautiful island on the beach.
Yeah.
is wonderful.
Yes. Oh, thank you. Yes. It's an awesome program where the dogs can be themselves outside of this stressful, compact environment. It's difficult for a dog to be their true selves in shelter. So this program allows humans and dogs to, you know, experience a fun time together, a fun day of hiking or beach.
And love.
And ultimately love.
For people, Kiani, mm-hmm. who would say, but there's so much loss. Really this much attention to dogs, you'd say what?
Oh, goodness. I mean, someone has to be their voice. That's why we are here. I know that's why I'm here. Yeah.
You have a quote from Martin Luther King at the entranceway here.
Yes, that's correct. Never, never be afraid to do what's right, especially if the well-being of a person or animal is at stake.
Or animal.
Yes.
All right. Hi, Trevor.
Hi, Trevor, buddy.
Bye.
She keeps giving you treats.
No. Bye. Bye. Okay, I'm not crying. We will link you to the Maui Humane Society at herenow.org. You can donate from the mainland or sign up for a slot for Dog on Demand if you are in Maui. They also take walk-in volunteers starting at noon. Then there's the group Feed My Sheep Maui. These are volunteers who help deliver free groceries. You can plant a tree, donate to different funds. Hands on Maui is another good site. Just Dula Lima, which in Hawaiian means cooperation, a tree of hands working together. And don't forget, there are plenty of overwhelmed animal shelters on the mainland. Many also have dog on demand programs. And some, like the Maui Humane Society, do not euthanize dogs for lack of space, but many others have to. So, did I mention, it's PetSmart National Adoption Week? Just saying.
Robin Young in Hawaii. I know what you're wondering. And yes, we've got some pics of those pups at hereandnow.org. That's our show. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Lynn Manigan and Karen Miller-Medson. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, Peter O'Dowd, and Micaela Rodriguez. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto, Caleb Green, and Michaela Varela. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. NPR Wine Club members have contributed over $1.5 million to helping create a more informed public. B21. Join the charge at nprwineclub.org/podcast. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.